there, Conscious Living and Power Radio. I'm Wendy. Thank you for listening. I appreciate your time. Hope you're having a good Valentine's month. It's just a shame it's only one day. Okay, there's just something about that. But it's nice to have boundaries. So maybe we have to eat chocolate just on occasion to appreciate it more. I do have a guest today who's out walking her dog. This is so perfect because Victoria Price has the book, The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self. And I think you are entitled, when you are proficient at knowing how to be lost and do it in a really, really good way, that your dog is with you on the trip. That is the perfect way of being lost. So at Victoria Price, if you recognize the name and you ever, ever in your lifetime watched a Vincent Price film, guess what? They're related. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fabulous. And I'm so glad that you are not lost at the moment, okay? That we can track you. That's excellent.
Well, at least one of us isn't lost. My dog knows the way. I just follow her. I'm on the other end of the leash.
Dogs are very important. Yes, that's basically our grounding. They remind us that life is really, really cool if we would just quit being so serious. I want to get first into, you are Vincent Price's daughter. And so there comes a huge thing that you probably have no connection to at all, but this fantasy about who Vincent Price was, is, and as a kid, when I would watch the films, and I, you know, now see them, they're running them on MeTV or Comet. I can't remember which one with they have certain, you know, certain weeks. I saw one with the bikini gang recently.
Yes. Dr. Dolphit and the girl bombs. It's hilarious.
Yes. 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 So anyway, there's this whole thing about him that, I know you without knowing you, and that is so not fair to you, but you know, I think when I saw those, I thought, if I could have my dad, it would be either Vincent Price or Elvis Presley. Don't ask me why. I was probably about six.
I love that. But what an interesting combo plate.
They were
actually in a movie together, but they never met. They were in a movie called Blue Hawaii, but they never met.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I know, what was it, the last film that he did, Edward Scissorhands?
Yes.
Okay, and were you in that? I was read through this.
I was, yes. I played a news reporter, and I ran after Johnny Depp, and a friend of mine quipped. She said, "That's the fastest I've ever seen you run." I thought, "Well, yeah, I'm running after Johnny Depp. Who wouldn't run that?"
Hello, go figure.
Exactly.
Well, with that, I think, you know, when you're writing about the way of being lost, it's the last thing I think that I would have pictured with being able to be connected with your dad and that whole Hollywood, just the scene of people seeming to have things together and plans and itineraries. And yet, as a child growing up in that atmosphere, there was probably a whole lot of, a lot of chaos because of you being kind of along for the ride. Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, you know, I came from very, very driven parents, and they were much older than most of the other parents of the kids in my class. My dad was 1 month shy of his 51st birthday when I was born. My mother was 45, and I was her first child. And my mother was a very successful costume and architectural designer. And my dad not only was doing all these very famous movies, but he was also doing a program where he sold fine art for Sears Roebuck, like Picasso's, that he would go all over the world buying art. He bought something like 20,000 pieces of art for Sears and Roebuck, and you could buy amazing pieces of art. And he was writing a syndicated art column, and he lectured on the visual arts all over the world. And so these are these incredibly busy people, and they're my parents. And all of a sudden, I come along, clearly unexpected. And they were incredibly excited, but also, how do you squeeze a kid into a life that's that busy? And so I spent a lot of time kind of trying to figure out my place by trying to understand the world by looking at it. In other words, from my earliest memories, I was always looking at the world, trying to make sense of it. And I think that set me up for a lifetime of maybe overthinking on some level, but also really trying to understand, you know, why are we here? Why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing? And then on top of that, when these busy people are incredibly famous and constantly being greeted with all of this adulation and being treated differently than the average person, then there's very strange disconnect. And of course, I grew up in the 60s, so what I was watching on television were, you know, the news about the Vietnam War with the body count every night. And I was watching, you know, Martin Luther King give talks. And I was so, what moved and motivated me were the stories about social justice and right and wrong. And so there was this whole trying to make sense of the world, looking at it from I would have to say now, such a different perspective than most kids have. And I think that set me up for a life of a lot of questioning.
Well, that, and I think one of the things that struck me was when you were back, what, six, your blue period with the art, was it four or six? It was, and I thought,
yes,
that was such
four.
A... Okay, that was a fabulous story, and I'll let you tell it about that lovely little finger painting, you know, painting watercolor creation that you made.
Yes. Well, I was about 4 years old, and my parents were super into school, so I started school at 2 years old, and I never missed a day. And I was pulled out of school early and brought home to change into one of my favorite outfits. So this was like a big deal to be taken, you know, home from school, out of the uniform, into the nice outfit. And I knew it was because of me, because my piece of art had been chosen to be in this citywide art show of children's art. And right before we were about to leave the house, my mother sort of knelt down and said, "Your father and I need you to understand something, because we don't want you to be hurt later. They didn't pick your piece of art because you're particularly talented. They picked it because they wanted Dad there." And my dad at that point, as I had said, was, you know, buying art for Sears. He was as famous at that point in his life for being an arts advocate and an art expert as he was for being an actor. And so I remember in that moment really knowing that she was telling me the truth. And yet, there was something about that moment that always stuck with me. And I loved art. I wanted to make art. I was always taking drawing classes, painting and drawing. But in that moment, I realized that this thing that really was just a source of joy for me had a whole other context to it, that there were people who were good enough to make art. There were people who were good enough to be chosen. There was a whole thing around celebrity that had to do with this thing that just brought me pure joy. And from that moment on, something that just came naturally the way it does to kids that just brought me joy became a source of questioning. And it stuck with me for years. And I've been an art dealer. I've had an art gallery. I've lived with people who are wonderful artists. And yet, I never saw myself as someone who could make art, although I photographed my whole life. And it's only been in recent years that I've allowed myself to find the joy in photography again. I now take a picture every single day, and I've had my first art show, and I show my photographs online. And that's because I was able to sort of understand that the joy that I came into the world having around creativity was changed in that moment, because it stopped just being about pleasure and it became about outcome. And I think that was a really, really incredible lesson. Not then, of course, my mother thought she was giving me this important life lesson then, but really the lesson came much later when I realized that it is so important that we try to retain our joy around things and not be focused on external results and outcomes. And that's something that the world doesn't talk that much about.
Well, and I wanted to get into that because basically that's the setup for your way of having at the very young age some expectations that may not have been yours. And so then that sets you into a lifestyle of being extremely dedicated, driven, expected to have a high, you know, to make up for that feeling of not worthy, to maybe over excel. And you describe in your book the workaholic aspect. And I thought, well, that would make such perfect sense, because you're told, okay, you don't quite measure up. And so then you are, being the person that you are, driven to say, okay, I'll compensate. And there comes this way of what you describe as some really fantastic successes, but they weren't right. They weren't heartfelt. And that's the way I interpret it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. I think the word that is the culprit, and it ought to be a four-letter word, is the word should. The moment we start thinking in terms of should, the moment we are operating from some sense of duty, obligation, responsibility, pity, should, we've stepped out of our natural impulse for joy. Now, I'm not suggesting that there aren't things that we all have to do in our lives that we have to do. You know, we have to pay the bills. We have to do many things that we don't necessarily want to do. But I think if in an early age, the things that bring us joy are encased in a whole set of expectations. It's fun watching the Olympics, right? Because these are kids who, many of whom have known what they wanted to do from a very, very young age. And there's something about the Olympics, regardless of all the hype, that still contains this element of childlike joy for us all. This sense of a little kid looking at something and thinking, I want that. I want to do that. Now, in order to succeed as an Olympian, you have to work harder than most of us will ever work in our lives to excel at whatever it is they're excelling at. So it's not that the work is the problem. It's the impetus behind the work. And I think one of the reasons that we're still so drawn to the Olympics is that we see these kids, or in many cases, people who have gone on to be in their 30s, or in some cases now even their 40s, and they have worked at this super high level, but they have worked because there is this sense of joy at the outcome. And that's something that, for me, when I lost that, when I'm constantly trying to prove something to other people or to myself or my mother in my head, I lost my joy. And yes, that's when you become a workaholic. And that's been a big part of my adult life, is trying to get all those voices out of my head. I still have to do it every day and figure out, where is the joy? Where is just the basic joy in this? And I was just chatting with a friend about social media, because it's interesting. I don't really understand social media because I'm not social in that way. But I love Instagram because it's about photographs, and I love photographs. I love the visual. So for I enjoy checking Instagram because the things that I follow are beautiful images of nature, of birds, or of, you know, animals, or design, or architecture. And I love the imagery. And I like posting. I sort of think of it, we all have these little galleries that we post in. So there's an element of joy to that. Whereas Twitter just baffles me completely. I don't understand it at all. And Facebook is only marginally less baffling, because I never was that person who wanted to stand around the water cooler chatting, which is essentially what Facebook is, right? I would rather be in the museum, and that's what Instagram is. But my friend was saying, but, you know, people write such lovely things and they're so sweet and connected. And I thought, well, yeah, but that's not particularly my form of connection. So I don't understand it. It feels more like something everybody is telling me to do because you have to be on social media. Whereas Instagram, I just love the little gallery that I, you know, am given the sweet little space to have my own little gallery out there in the ether. And and so I think it's about finding in all of the things that we're presenting where our joy is.
The Way of Being Lost, Road Trip to My Truest Self by Victoria Price. I was reading that. The thing I found incredibly, revealing in terms of what happened was the more success that you acquired, the more pressure you seemed to have on yourself to continue to excel beyond that level. And it was never, even if somebody else would consider that absolutely astronomical and fantastic and superior, for you, it seemed to be each time you reached that next height, there was a void that it just didn't ever measure up to where you had hoped it would be. And when you come to the terms, I think in 2011, and say, I am, and you say you're looking in a mirror, and if you're going to be this miserable for the next 40 years, it's not worth it. And there is such an opposite there with the way people visualize success, because you are and were successful by most terms. And so to see that that was completely not going to measure up is absolutely, it's in a way, it's like, what a lesson, what a revelation that it isn't about that external thing, because if it isn't in your heart, then there wasn't anything that was ever going to make that for you sufficient or satisfying. And did I misinterpret that?
No, in fact, thank you for saying it, because it's something I've been thinking a lot about as my book is coming out, because of course, attached to a book, if you have the good fortune in this day and age to have a publisher who is behind you and an agent who is cheerleading you on and a publicist who is trying to get your book out there, and you have the good fortune, which a lot of people don't have in this day and age, to have these people on your team, there's this sense again of that they have a set of goals for it, and it's your job to make sure that it succeeds for them. And I've been having to remind myself over and over again that the reason I wrote this book was twofold. One was because I've always written to make sense of my own life. And so the moment I had that epiphany in the mirror, I knew that part of how I would understand where I had to go and what I had to do and how I needed to show up to my own life was by writing it. So that was a purely internal thing. And then also because books, you know, when you grow up as the kid of somebody in the entertainment industry, you don't look at movies and television as a wonderful form of escape because, you know, you've been on the back lot. You know,
we had
birthday parties in the Walton schoolroom. You know it's a set. You don't think they live in wherever the heck the Waltons were supposed to live, Tennessee or wherever it was. You know that the Walton schoolroom is in Burbank. And so you don't fall for that illusion, but books. Oh my goodness. My parents were so absent and I was a voracious reader. And so I fell in love with books, and books saved my life, and they still save my life. I live on the road and I listen to audiobooks when I drive. And when I recorded my first audiobook a couple of years ago, they were trying to give me some tips about, you know, how to think about it. And they said, an audiobook is the most intimate conversation you will ever have with a total stranger. And I thought, oh, that's so wonderful. And that's how I feel. I'm listening to these audiobooks, and sometimes somewhere in the middle of text, I'll be so moved by something someone has just said that I'll pull over to the side of the road and I'll email the author. You just said to me, blah, blah, blah. Thank you. I needed to hear that today because it feels exactly like that. And so books and audiobooks for me are this conversation where there's a whole world of people, some of whom aren't even alive, who are sharing their wisdom and their understanding. And I wanted to contribute to that conversation. So that's why I wrote the book. And yet, there's all this set of expectations about what a book means and what a book is. And my little workaholic self is like, you got to do it. You got to get out there. You got to hustle. And I won't let myself be still. And thank you for saying that, because it's a reminder that we have to get back to the core reasons why we do anything. And those core reasons have to come down to love and joy and connection and communication and support. Because if they don't, we're damned from the start. And so thank you for saying that. That's absolutely true. It never feels good enough, because I have parents who had extraordinarily high standards, and I'm always trying to reach those standards in my head.
Well, and it's not a negative. It's just a pattern and a preset and a mold. And so when I saw that, it was almost, in a way, it was devastating to know that no matter how incredibly talented and tremendously gifted you are, you don't, in your heart, have the ability to say, God, it's so cool to be me. God, I just am so lucky. And you say it, but with this and having to go through, and that's why I think the way of being lost is so important, a road trip to my truest self, you jettisoned all of those signs and trappings of success and said, I have to figure out who I am so that you could value yourself. And see, I see tremendous, I look at your artwork and I think, oh my gosh, beautiful colors, beautiful way of visualizing and letting other people see what you're going through. I saw one of the posts that you made. There was somebody who said, I was thinking of suicide until I read this. So, and I just thought, you know, you are reaching people in ways you cannot begin to fathom. And even though your parents were too busy, they gave you a platform and said, go for it. And I believe your dad is right there saying, what have you got to lose? What have you got to lose? And I just see you as successful no matter what you do, with your little dog beside you right now going, thank God we're walking longer than I ever had planned because mom is walking around the block.
Thank you. You know, I feel like I should send you a check after this hour because you're helping me so much. Well, now we have somebody has joined us for our conversation. It is the cutest puppy you have ever seen. Oh my gosh. It's this big fluff ball of a puppy. Oh, so cute. It wants to play with my dog.
Of course. Of course. Cute. It's like, oh good. A tourist. Yay.
Yes.
I know how that goes.
Oh, I wish I had a video phone so everybody could see how cute this puppy is. Ridiculous.
Are you still on the road?
Thank you so much.
In terms, are you still out of? Are you at this point? Have you settled anywhere? Are you still out?
No.
Being, okay.
I am still out on the road. I made a promise to myself because I know that planning has always been this way of kind of assuaging my anxiety. And so I thought, do not plan anything for 2 years. In other words, don't start thinking where you're going to be, what's going to happen for 2 years. What I didn't anticipate was that once you kind of make this decision, you can't really go backwards in the sense that, you know, I don't have any furniture. I don't have a home. I've kind of put everything on the line to make this choice. So the 2 years are coming to an end and I don't have a clue what I'm going to do. I really don't know. And that not knowing is actually a huge gift because I think, you know, so often in life, what happens is we want to believe these false assurances. So of course, what you described need to be the best as if there's some quantifiable best, right?
Yeah.
That need to be the best is a false sense of security or comfort, right? The need to reach certain benchmarks. If I get there, I'll feel good, you know? And the bottom line is there is no finish line. So we have to just keep moving forward. And yeah, I live on the road. I'm intentionally homeless. I don't have the remotest clue what I'm going to do, but I'm putting one foot in front of the other. And really, honestly, what I'm trying to learn is that just doing that is okay. Just that one foot in front of another. And it's funny, right? You write a book and you hope that it will help some people. And you put it out there and then all of a sudden you realize that everything that you've written are lessons that you still need to learn. So there is no neat little bow at the end of the way of being lost. I share in ways that I hope will encourage and inspire and motivate and comfort people in their own journeys of self-discovery. But what I feel like ultimately happens is we have to be willing to keep learning the same lessons over and over and over again. And eventually some of them begin to shift and clear. And when you feel that happen, like, for example, my mother's voice was always this very, you know, disciplinarian, doubting voice in my head. And as I've let her go, now I only feel a joyful sense of connection to her. But 2 years ago, I wouldn't have believed that was possible. So I can say to myself, look, one of the things I've lost on the way of being lost was this voice that wasn't really serving me. I always used to be late all the time. And people would give me all these helpful hints about how to be more on time. And I didn't really, you know, I tried to take them in, but I didn't know how to shift it. And
hold
it was
on,
really
hold on,
only
hold on.
By...
Victoria, we're going to take a break here. We're going to take a break here real quick, but we're going
to
pick up
that
thing of what that late, because that's a clue. Yeah. That's a real big clue.
Absolutely.
The way of being
sorry,
lost.
And the telemarketer called again. So that was part of the problem.
We're going to take a break. Victoria Price, The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self. And you're hearing right now because she's on a walk with her dog. But I think it's a perfect setup, the perfect scenario for somebody who is out and in between. Kind of that in between, not attached and not detached, experiencing a way of being authentic. All right. So stick around and we'll come back with more. And we're going to ask a little bit more about Dad, too. He's here. Okay. So don't go anywhere. Empower Radio. Conscious Living continues.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared.
It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs.
I start to cough. Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Today, one out of 13 children suffer from some form of asthma, accounting for nearly one-third of all emergency room visits.
I feel like I'm choking.
It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest. A little whistle sound comes out when I breathe.
But while your child may suffer from asthma, asthma doesn't have to make your child suffer. There are simple ways you can prevent your child's next attack. To learn more, log on to www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
This is why you work so hard to pay the mortgage. Because home is more than four walls and a roof. It's that porch swing on a summer night. It's pajamas with feet and everybody over for Sunday dinner. And that old stuffed chair in the living room you just can't get rid of. This is why you work a second job. This is why you learn to fix things yourself so you could save on repairs. Because home is your place, your memories, your family sleeping in their own beds at night. And that is why we want to help. We are Making Home Affordable, a free government resource that can make paying the mortgage easier. And now even more options are available. Call 888-995-HOPE today. That's 888-995-HOPE. Or visit makinghomeaffordable.gov.
Good night, Mama.
This is why. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Kelly Clarkson, and I've toured the country dozens of times, and there's one thing every state has in common: childhood hunger. The sad truth is that 17 million kids don't know where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Yet there are billions of pounds of surplus food around the country at farms and warehouses that could help end this injustice. But all that food is useless if it doesn't get where it needs to go. That's why the Feeding America Nationwide Network of Food Banks gathers surplus food and gets it to hungry kids before it goes to waste. But they can't do it without your help. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank. Find out how at feedingamerica.org. Together we can solve hunger. Together we're Feeding America.
To help solve hunger in your community and to find your local food bank, visit feedingamerica.org. That's feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Conscious Living and Power Radio. Hi there, I'm Wendy. Thanks for sticking around. This is one of those things that I think it's a perfect example of how life works. The book is called The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self. And my guest, Victoria Price, is actually the daughter of Vincent Price. So I have all sorts of memories without ever having met Victoria that I think I know her dad. And of course I don't. I just have this sense of he's my dad too. And I'm thrilled with that. None of it's reality.
I love that. I love it.
It's just, you know, I wasn't a big fan of super scary films, But I was a fan of, I think, The Haunting of Hill House. And there were some in there that, as a kid, I like the mystery. I like the unknown. I like ghosts. I had my own experiences. So I'm very, very familiar with that kind of thing, as it really is real, not the Hollywood version. So that was from my youth, a very solid framework. And then I happened to come across Mary and Vincent's cookbook. I thought, oh my gosh, this is Vincent Price and his wife. This is their cookbook. I will do something with that. I had no idea what I was going to do. And I set it back maybe 8 months ago, and then I found it again, and I found it recently. And on your website, you're like, well, now I need to do something. Am I going to make anything in this cookbook? Am I going to track it down? And it's all French recipes. No. Anyway, when I'm tracking it down, trying to find it, I'm finding other versions, unique twists on classic recipes from this. So it keeps coming back. And then I find out you have just written a book and you're on the road. I think, well, this is perfect timing. So I pick up the phone and call you, and everything just kept falling into place. The big thing is, what I wanted to get was that you have such a wonderful opportunity because of your dad to forge new ground, new territory, remind people what a fun time that was. The Hollywood time, not the life and the behind the scenes, but the fantasy. Because I look at that, I wanted to play the Michael Jackson Thriller when your dad, the voice that came in there, because it's such a mindset. This is theater of the mind. And when I hear your father's voice in anything, I'm automatically transported, like you said, you listen to audiobooks, to a different world. And that's what he gave me, is that wonderful creation, that beautiful fantasy that I created, a totally separate reality where he's my dad and I'm not frightened. How's that?
I love it. I love it.
That's what we do.
You know, my dad always said that the imagination is so much more powerful than anything we could ever show on screen. And that's why people still love the old radio shows so much. That's why the old movies are still popular, because you don't see what happens after the kiss. You don't see what happens after knife goes into the air or the gun gets shot. And our imaginations are so powerful. And now that we can see everything, I think partially that's what, you know, is causing all the violence in the world, because we see these terrible things happen and we imagine that they're not real. It's almost like we've gone 180 degrees in the wrong direction. And so our imaginations, that time was such a time of powerful invention. And of course, before that, you know, the book, the idea that we could see something in words and have a whole vision of what that was playing out as the movie in our minds. And I think that we don't get that opportunity as much anymore, because it's all laid out for us.
The fun thing I connect with now is the science fiction and the new things that are happening as a result of these things that were in people's minds. I wanted to go back when you were talking about, you know, being late and being chronically late. And did you understand, how did you reconcile that with what was happening in your life?
Well, I couldn't understand why I couldn't kick the habit. I'm a super disciplined person about many things. And I always get my 10,000 steps in. I mean, many things I'm very disciplined about eating. I've been either for pretty much my entire adult life. And why couldn't I break this habit? And people would say things to me that would just be heartbreaking. Like, you know, it's disrespectful to the person who's waiting for you. I know. And I couldn't break it. And then when I literally jettisoned everything and began to live on the road, I found that I had time for things that I didn't otherwise have time for, which I still sometimes feel guilty about, that I have time to sleep an extra hour sometimes if I want to, or I can choose to do something fun. Because if you're a workaholic, Your sense of self-worth is derived from always doing too much and always being behind the eight ball and having enough time for anything. So the moment I gave myself the permission to have a little more time for myself, paradoxically, by giving myself time, I stopped being late. And I realized that the reason I was late was that I would work up to the point where I had an appointment. And then in that moment that allowed me X amount of time to get from the work to the next work, let's say, I would feel unconsciously pissed off that I didn't yes. have any time for myself.
Yes.
And so yeah. I would dawdle. I would take 10 minutes, like all of a sudden in that 10 minutes, I would decide to look up a recipe for something, or the idea would come, gosh, I really want to know, you know, when was curling invented? Like, who cares? But yeah. all of a sudden I'd be there trying to find out when curling was invented, as if I needed to know that in that moment, and then I'd be late. And I realized it took me creating time for myself to realize that I had not shown up to myself. Therefore, mm-hmm. I was resentful about having to show up to anyone else. So the moment I began learning how to show up to myself, which still sometimes niggles me and I feel guilty about, but the moment I learned how to show up to myself, the moment I ended up being prompt, I mean, I think there are people who still are shocked that I show up on time, my best friend. The other day I walked in, I was in New Mexico and we walk all the time. And I, you know, she always leaves her front door open for me. So I walk in and she goes, what are you doing here? And I said, we're walking. She said, well, yeah, but not now. I have to eat. And I said, didn't you just say we were going to walk? She said, yeah, but you know, it's you.
It's you.
I'm trying to eat dinner. You know, she still can't get used to the fact that when I say I'm going to be there, I get there. And the reason being, I actually want to go for a walk with her. And I've actually made the time to do it because I want to take care of myself. And that's a really hard thing to look at. You're a workaholic, that self-care is not something to feel guilty or bad about.
Well, part of it, and see, I have had these kinds of issues off and on. Part of it, to me, my explanation and the way I found that it worked, it was spiritual rebellion. I was doing things I had no real vested interest in. I was showing up for somebody else. I had agreed, I had committed, I had set myself up. At the same time, it's like, I'm doing it because this is the program that I'm supposed to follow. And I was so irritated and frustrated at having to go by somebody else's assignment and their rules for a successful life, a successful business, a successful career, whatever you want to call it, that the only way I could rebel was to say, I'll show up on my time. I don't care that I'm late because it's not my time. This isn't my idea. And so that was a very bold and counterproductive act of rebellion, but it was the way I had control. And so by
that act,
I was saying, I don't like what I'm doing.
Yes, essentially I was doing the same thing, except a little more consciously than you, because I kept thinking, you know, I want to be on time. And part of me did, but my true self, the real me, didn't want to be on time because I hadn't actually made the time for myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And see, I attributed it to my grandfather who was chronically late. I said, well, you know, it runs in the genes.
Right.
Thank you, Grandpa.
See, now my dad was an hour or two early to everything.
Oh,
and it was just, my God, he hated that I was so late. Hated it. One time I literally blew out a car engine driving up the hill to his house because I was so late and I knew how mad he'd be. And I was just, I mean, there's no way driving fast was going to make me more on time, but it was a way of assuaging my anxiety.
Yes.
And I literally,
I tried,
when I got up there. Right, exactly.
Okay, I wanted to get back with your dad. You had, you guys both had, later on, when you reconnected with him, what was that like? When he was older, you're an adult, and at the same time, his health is failing.
It was really a gift, because we'd always stayed close, but he married a woman who called herself my wicked stepmother. I think that's really never a good thing when they call themselves your wicked stepmother. And she was very threatened by how close he was with his kids. And so she got in the way of our relationship. So my dad would have to sneak around trying to, you know, have time for us, my brother and me. And so after she died, then all of a sudden we had this time where we could choose to be together and do whatever we wanted and begin to have the conversations that we hadn't been able to have for so long. And the thing that was interesting was that I had this kind of view of life that it was a series of snapshots. And I wanted to go back to, you know, the photo album of me and my dad at age, you know, 10. And, you know, life is fluid. Life is not a series of snapshots. And at this point, my dad wasn't that man. He was ill. And he needed me to not need him to be that kind of dad. Yeah. And I didn't understand that then. So, yes, we had an amazing connection and we had amazing conversations. And it was absolutely a gift to have that time. But looking back now, you know, almost, well, close to 25 years later, over 25 years later, I look back at that time and I think, gosh, you know, I wish I had known a little more about life than I did then. And I wish I could have understood that he didn't need me to be his daughter anymore. First of all, me wanting to be that must have sort of thrown in his face the ways that he hadn't been. And that wasn't how I felt. I just wanted that time back. Mm-hmm. I wanted the time back before my stepmother. So it was a beautiful time. We worked on books together. We talked about art. We had wonderful, funny family vacations, more like staycations and excursions. And we played games, which had been a lifelong aspiration of my childhood. You know, I always wanted to be like the normal kids whose families played, you know, had game night. We didn't have game night in our house. We went to museums, you know, and all of a sudden we played games. We watched Jeopardy and competed with each other. In many ways, it was a fulfillment of what I had wanted, but the bittersweet aspect of it for me is that there comes a point where we switch places with our parents.
Yeah.
And I was too young to really understand that I needed to be able to give my dad more than I, at that point, understood how to give. So I sometimes I wish I could have a do-over.
Yeah, I know. And life is just, that's one of those little funky things about life. Do-overs don't exist, except do better. And that when you are going to the Monster Paloozas that opened you to a whole new audience, a whole new level of fandom, that had to be and has to be a way of saying, gosh, Dad, I really never knew you, but I appreciate you even more now. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Well, I feel like on some level I knew my dad almost better than anyone because we are so similar. And that my relationship with my mother was very much like his relationship with my mother. But there was an aspect of my dad that is different from me, which is that he was absolutely an extrovert. And he was lit up and turned on from the inside out by other people. And when I go to the conventions and I get to spend time with people who love my dad as much as I do and are so excited to share their connection with him, with me, what happens, the beautiful thing that happens is I get to remember him in me. I almost feel like I'm standing in his shoes and remembering the qualities that we share. And the main one of those qualities is joy. He was just the most joy-filled person. And to remember joy, to remember, I feel it. You know, I go to those conventions and I'm not an extrovert, but for that 10 hours that I'm standing there chatting with people, I feel like somebody is plugged in and the currency running through me is joy. And that, oh my goodness, that is a gift. And it's why a big part of my book is a love letter to the horror fans, because they really gave my dad back to me, but they also gave me the gift of understanding why we need heart tribes and why we need people who we connect with from our hearts.
Well, there's also an unconditional thing, because with this, you don't have to perform. Where if he showed up, he was performing. He was on stage. He was the star, the stage master. You don't have that same pressure. You get to go up and say, you get to cherish that, that fantasy that we have. I mean, I want to know, well, so what was his favorite recipe? Did the two of you share a favorite recipe? Was there something in there? You know, did you guys have popcorn? Just goofy things like that, because of how I remember your dad. And just really, you know, it makes no sense, but that's how the imagination works. It opens these doors and windows and trapdoors that you don't even know are there until you get to exchange time and conversation with somebody who is a representation of somebody that you admired or that you fantasized about or that you had a connection with through film and through performance art that opens our imagination to things that we don't dream until we see somebody else, hear somebody else, experience somebody else say, look what I did, look what I can do, and this you can do and more. Does it make sense?
Totally makes sense. And I think, you know, that was one of the profound gifts that my dad had. He understood that he had been given the gift of celebrity and fame, but the only way that it would be worth something is if he could use it to motivate other people to live their lives as their truest selves. Because the real problem that we're having in the world right now is that we're all living these artificial, inauthentic, I mean, all, we're trying not to, but we're programmed of artificially and inauthentically because we're trained to specialize. We're trained to think about what we should do. We're trained to think that that is a good thing. And so my dad would go out and say to people, what do you want to do? What do you want to be? What do you want to love? How do you want to love? Do it. Do what you love. And of course, he did that with me as well. But the thing that was different with me is I was his daughter and he was worried, you know, he didn't want me to end up being, you know, penniless pushing a shopping cart. So there was a little bit of should and fear in there with me. But with others who he didn't have to worry about, he was like, go do what you want to do. And I think that when I think about why Vincent Price has remained so popular, you know, we started his Facebook page, I don't know, like 3.5 years ago, not very long ago, maybe not even that long. And he has almost 250,000, like 246,000 or something Facebook followers. And he's been gone 25 years. And I think the reason that that's the case is that what comes through about him as you look at his films, as you look at his life, is that he was authentic in whatever he did. He always looked like he was having a good time. He always took time to connect with others, no matter how silly or ridiculous what he was doing was. He was all in. If he was cooking up your poodles and feeding you a poodle pie, which was pretty much the last thing on the planet he, an animal lover, would have done, he was all in feeding that poodle pie to Robert Morley in Theater of Blood. And so he went into life with both feet and a big smile on his face. And so many of us don't. We tiptoe through our lives and we have so much trepidation. And I think that that is still a gift, to be able to look at people like that and think, oh, what a wonderful thing. I recently found this great quote by Hafiz, and it sort of re-inspired me to think about what the point of life is and how we live it. And, you know, it says, I'll read it to you if I can find it. It says, it's impossible, said pride. It's risky, said experience. It's pointless, said reason. Give it a try, whispered the heart. And we have gotten so used to paying more attention to the impossible, risky, and pointless, and that we forget to listen to the whisperings of the heart, which are always saying, give it a try, give it a try, give it a try. And it's the reason why, despite, you know, most of us thinking that Valentine's Day is, you know, a commercial holiday, the hope of love is still one of the few things that can get us all to jump into life feet first.
What I wanted to get back before we run out of time to, I'm in Kansas, and you make some correlations here about the Wizard of Oz. How did that,
yes,
for you, how did that come into play?
Well, I love growing up in an era where everything wasn't always instant gratification. And so when I was growing up, they would show the Wizard of Oz every Thanksgiving weekend, just like they show the Ten Commandments every Easter weekend. And so we would watch it. Always my mom and I, but sometimes my mom and my dad and I. And my mother was a very metaphysical person. And so she loved to sort of use whatever we did together as an opportunity to give me life lesson. And she liked to tell me about the business. Like, she would say, oh, well, you know, Liza Minnelli, you just saw her on television. Well, Dorothy is her mother, which was just baffling to me. I'd be like, what?
Oh.
Dorothy's like a teenager. How can she be mother? I don't understand. You know, or she'd say, oh, you know, remember we were on Rodeo Drive the other day and we talked to that nice tall man? He was the Scarecrow. I'm like, Scarecrow on Rodeo Drive? I mean, it's all just baffling. She thought she was giving me these lessons about, you know, what is Hollywood and these are actors. But
the
other big lesson that I got from my mother about the Wizard of Oz was the end, of course, where Dorothy wakes up and she's surrounded by everyone she loves. And she realized that what she's been looking for has always been in her backyard, and it's always been in herself and in her heart. And I realized that for me, that teaching has always been the most essential teaching, that we're not trying to find something outside of ourselves. We're trying to wake up from this dream that we need anything that we don't already have. You know, we're born with the good. We're born with the love. We're born with the ability to connect without judgment. And we're born not steeped in fear. And then we begin to lard on all the shoulds and the things that we're taught. And we lose that sense of who we are and our sense of innate well-being in the world, sometimes incredibly early. And so for me, the Wizard of Oz was a wonderful metaphor. But then at a time when I needed it most, somebody said to me, just sort of tossed off something about, you know, lacing up my red shoes. And I realized, as somebody who has chosen to live intentionally homeless, that my red shoes were my little reminder that home is right where I am. I just have to remember to lace up my red shoes and click my heels together and say there's no place like home, which is in my own heart. And then, of course, I travel with my little Toto, who is Allie, who travels with me everywhere. So I have this wonderful reminder that I kind of have become Dorothy.
I wrote a poem this morning, or maybe not a poem, but some words. And I thought, I wondered why I was writing it, but now I know I was writing it for you. There's a secret realm hidden in plain view. One question. Do you believe in magic? Close your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Now answer. Open your eyes. What do you see? That's your magic. So what you did in that moment of closing your eyes and opening them is an opportunity to transition from the Wizard of Oz to the world of magic and home in your heart, wherever you are. I love the fact that you are risking and you are brave and you are successful and accomplished and authentic. And I think that you have a lot to offer for people who are struggling to just be comfortable in their own shoes. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Honestly, thank you for saying that. Thank you for speaking from your heart to my heart and to the hearts of people out there. You know, we all want to feel like we're showing up and doing something that will help other people. But in this age of hype, the idea of help sometimes takes on grandiose terms. And you're right, you know, it's all about just what can we give to one another and how can we connect to one another in just a sweet kind of conversation and connection. And that was so beautiful what you read. Thank you. And thank you for everything kind that you said. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. We got to get going. If you're listening, this is the end of conversation. Yes. But the beginning of a relationship and a connection, check out Victoria Price and the website, victoriaprice.com, The Way of Being Lost, A Road Trip to My Truest Self, and find your new connections. Thank you for listening. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio. Thank you, Victoria. I appreciate everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful conversation.
Thank you.